This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
First world riding high, second world standing by, third world under fire, funny how we all conspire. We don't know 'cause we can't see how such a way could come to be. Riding on a spinning wheel, soon enough will be revealed. Whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this?
What the heck happened to winter? One day you're jogging in snowless Chicago in a t-shirt, or enjoying 70 degrees, that's 21 degrees C at the end of January in Washington, D.C., 24 hours later, it's big winter jackets, and watch out for that frostbite. We'll talk with journalist and scientist Andrew Friedman to see what new science is saying about Freaky 2013. Then you'll join me for a talk with a shrink. With all the bad news, we sure need one. Kathy McMahon is the Peak Oil Shrink, a clinical psychologist who specializes in energy, climate, and the recovery that looks more like a depression every day. Kathy tells us about Nicole Foss, Sucky Collapse, and a surprising turn in her own life. Time on and off the couch with Radio EcoShock. I'm your audio companion, Alex Smith. Remember normal winters? Actually, anyone under the age of 26 may never have seen one. We may have thought global warming was just a bit more slush, but January 2013 showed us what climate disruption can really do. One January day, people in Chicago were out jogging in 60-degree heat, 15 degrees centigrade, with no snow. Just 30 hours later, the temperature dropped 60 degrees and more with an Arctic blast for a couple of days. It's been a strange, strange month in the Northern Hemisphere. Here to help us figure out what is going on, we have Andrew Friedman. He's the senior science writer for the respected blog Climate Central. Andrew is a professional reporter. He's published widely, and he holds a master's in climate and society from Columbia University. I'm Alex Smith. Andrew Friedman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I tracked you down because I found a series of fascinating articles about January weather and climate. You ended up with a small storm of scientific controversy along the way, perhaps. Why don't we start with some of the odd weather hitting North America in January 2013? What did we see?
Well, we saw really the first Arctic outbreak that we had of the entire winter in the lower 48 states in particular. Came down from Alaska, out of Canada, and into the U.S. sort of slowly but surely. And accompanying it were several pretty strong storm systems. But what's been remarkable in between those events in North America is we've had some very unseasonable weather, where we had temperatures in the low 70s in Washington, D.C., on January 30th, we were setting records for record warm temperatures, even at 6,000 feet over above New Hampshire. The month really just hasn't proceeded like you'd expect a typical January to. For example, even with these mild periods that we've had in the United States, for the month as a whole, warm air temperature records still outpaced cold air temperature records, which I found a little bit surprising. The ratio wasn't quite as big as it has been in the past, but it was still noticeable. And, you know, of course, around the world, we've had major events this year, you know, in 2013 so far, with what's been going on in Australia over the past couple of weeks.
Yes, and you wrote that in Minneapolis, in the northern state of Minnesota, they finally broke a record streak of more than 4 years without going below 0 degrees Fahrenheit or minus 17 degrees C. That stuns me. That's nothing like the northern state winters I grew up with. And it's been really, really strange in Chicago, too, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. In Chicago, they are going pretty much without snow this year. You know, they haven't had a pretty significant snowfall. They're running a significant deficit. We're seeing, even in the lake effect, snow bans, the traditionally favored areas in Michigan and in Minnesota and Wisconsin, they're really not keeping up with what they tend to get in a normal winter. In Minnesota, you know, they finally did go below zero, and they actually went well below zero. But this was news this time, when in a normal winter that wouldn't have been so newsworthy because it would have been ordinary. And this time, you know, actually seeing the cold temperatures that you used to expect was noteworthy.
Well, let's get to some of the science behind this. You've written about something called a sudden stratospheric warming event. What is that?
Well, it's somewhat complicated, which meant that it was a challenge to write about it in the first place. But basically what happens every few winters is that meteorologists observe a sudden warming taking place in the stratosphere. So the stratosphere is the layer of the atmosphere just above the troposphere. You've been to the stratosphere if you've flown in a passenger jet, because you tend to cruise between those atmospheric layers, really, above most of the weather. So what they observe is a warming in the stratosphere, which can take place over about a week or less. So a sudden warming event. And what happens is that the Arctic, the polar vortex, which is this band of wind that is circling around the North Pole, tends to be disrupted when you have a sudden stratospheric warming event. And when you disrupt the polar vortex, you can actually cause the Arctic itself, the temperatures there get milder. So the Canadian Arctic goes milder than average, but it's still pretty cold, of course. But the Arctic air gets dislodged. And they found, there's actually a new study out this week on how forecasts can be improved by paying attention to these events. So there's studies that indicate that when you have a sudden stratospheric warming event, a couple of weeks later, you tend to get a very cold air outbreak in the United States, in Europe. This can be favored in Europe. This can be favored in parts of Asia. The thing that's really not understood and that's really fascinating to me is exactly what causes these events and what are some of the predictors they can use to figure out how much lead time they can give on these events. And there are some theories that it's linked to snowfall in the fall season in northern Eurasia, believe it or not, which through a complicated series of events can actually cause energy to radiate up towards the stratosphere. That's just sort of one working theory. There's another theory on what led to the cold air outbreak in the United States as well, which is actually that it may be connected to a weather cycle, a natural variability cycle that occurs more in the tropics, which is a completely different region to look at. But the point being that, you know, what's gone on in January, the unusual events in January, and really the extreme events that we usually see are a combination of these natural variability players and man-made climate change. And when we see real huge extremes, it's when they're both acting in the same direction, when they're both favoring warming, for example, or both favoring flooding.
Yeah, I think you've put that really clearly. That's an important point to get. Well, one of the big scientific theories out there explaining strange weather patterns was advanced by Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers University and her team. And I know you've encountered some other scientists with second thoughts about that, but why don't we start with her views on the relationship between the big Arctic sea ice melt and changes to the jet stream? How would you explain her work?
Yeah, well, she and some of her colleagues have conducted really interesting studies over the past couple of years, basically going on the common sense view that you can't melt this huge amount of sea ice, thereby changing the dynamics of the ocean and atmosphere in the far north without having some effect on the weather of the northern hemisphere. It just sort of defies belief that that could have no impact whatsoever. So there's a lot of scientists that are trying to figure out, well, what are the impacts? And she has presented evidence showing that by warming the fall, mainly the atmosphere in the Arctic in the fall especially, and causing other changes in the lower atmosphere as well as the middle and upper atmosphere, you end up with basically a wavier, lazier jet stream in the northern hemisphere, where when you get these big undulations, these big ridges or troughs on weather maps, that's when weather patterns can stall out more. And when they stall out more, you tend to get the more extreme events. So, for example, a huge trough stalled out over the eastern seaboard captured Hurricane Sandy and tossed her back into the northeastern U.S. to devastating consequences. Blocking events, when you have a high-pressure area over Greenland that kind of blocks the weather coming in from the west and you have stalled weather patterns over North America, that has been linked in some of Jennifer Francis's work to the Arctic climate changes. Now, the scientific community is not really settled on this issue yet. There's some people who say that really the consequences of sea ice loss are felt mostly in the lower atmosphere over the Arctic, and it's mostly confined to the Arctic, and that the changes that we're seeing in blocking events and other sorts of extremes are related to other factors. So you see this playing out in the scientific journals and at scientific conferences, where some people are just keeping an open mind, some people are sort of fighting against that idea. But it's very fascinating evidence that makes sense to a lot of meteorologists, to a lot of people who deal with day-to-day weather, because what she's really showing is changes in some of the stuff that those people deal with every day, such as the jet stream and the wind flow at certain flight levels, that sort of thing.
Well, right. I interviewed Dr. Francis, and she objected a little bit to my calling it a theory because she says, well, the paper was just about observed facts. But it does seem like she's trying to advance an explanation here. Well, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with scientific journalist Andrew Friedman from Climate Central. We're talking about the possible climate or Earth systems causes behind the very weird weather of January 2013. Well, you talked about in your blog another phenomenon, and you just alluded to it earlier, the Madden-Julian Oscillation, or MJO. And I try and keep current on Earth systems, but I'd never heard of it. So can you help our listeners understand what it is and how that system might affect weather in North America?
Yeah, the MJO is something that tropical weather forecasters and hurricane specialists know a lot about and pay attention to. There's really very little reason for even a weather nerd in Canada or the U.S. to pay much attention to the MJO unless you get super into atmospheric dynamics. But basically, it's a cycle of showers and thunderstorms of convective activity that moves along the equator or near the equator and circles the globe in about every 45 days. So if you think about it as just an area of disturbed weather, if you're looking at the Earth from space, you'd say, hey, there's like a whole region of cloudiness and precipitation in the middle of the central Pacific near the equator. And then over time, the area of disturbed weather will sort of migrate eastward and then in 15 to 20 days be located over the central equatorial Atlantic and then kind of circle from there. And the reason why it's very relevant to hurricane specialists is because when the Madden-Julian Oscillation is in certain places or certain phases, as the scientists refer to it, it can favor the development of tropical storms and hurricanes in different ocean basins. So the hurricane forecasters at the National Hurricane Center will look and say, well, the MJO favors development in the Caribbean, and we have these other factors that also favor development. So that's where we're going to be looking for the next couple weeks, for example. The reason why it may be connected to some of the Arctic air moving south out of Alaska and Canada into the United States during part of January is that there are suggestions that the MJO can actually have an influence on the weather at much more northern latitudes, that through a series of interactions and atmospheric waves and interactions with the jet stream, one thing leads to another that ends up that when it's in certain phases, you can favor colder air entering the United States just as you might favor hurricane development in the Atlantic in a certain phase. The interesting thing is, you know, I wrote this story on the stratospheric warming event, which is something that a lot of meteorologists were paying attention to and really buy into. And then I was contacted by a climate scientist, the climate forecaster at the Climate Prediction Center in Maryland, who said, you know, there's a competing theory, which is that this is more related to the MJO. So that's when I got interested in looking into that and really discussing, well, how confident are we about the stratospheric warming event playing a role? And the whole story kind of just illustrates the complexity of what we're dealing with when we look at especially shorter-term weather and climate. When we're dealing with, as you know, long-term climate change, it's actually a little bit more simple because we're taking out so many of these complicating factors.
Right. These are early days, and our brains are pretty small, and we've got this very complex Earth system. You know, Andrew, Radio EcoShock also broadcasts in the United Kingdom, and we get podcast subscribers and downloaders in Ireland and so on. And their big weather question is something like, why are we drowning, and will we ever see the sun again? Have you heard a good explanation for why the wettest year ever recorded happened in that rainy island of the United Kingdom?
You know, I've heard the explanations that make the most sense to me are related to the sea surface temperature patterns in both the Pacific and the North Atlantic Ocean, and the Equatorial Atlantic as well. Usually the biggest role outside of man-made climate change, the biggest role is the background conditions, especially the status of different ocean cycles. I haven't really seen too many peer-reviewed studies that have come out on this. There may have been a couple. It's just been so recent that I don't think there have been all that many studies done on it. But there has been a very persistent jet stream pattern across the Atlantic, a very persistent trough of low pressure over the UK that has just brought them round after round after round of storms. And we've noticed in the past couple of weeks just some very intense North Atlantic storms that have actually fortunately only grazed the UK, bringing rain and actually some thunderstorms yesterday, which was highly unusual in January, on January 30th, I believe. But I think we'll be able to better answer that question in the coming months. I know that's probably not very comforting to folks there who are sick of it. But, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, next year you may end up in a prolonged dry spell and wishing that you were back here in this situation.
It's interesting we've had this whole conversation without mentioning El Nino or La Nina. That seems to have dropped out of the weather conversation this past year. Where are we in that cycle, and do we know what to expect?
It has and it hasn't. When I refer to, you know, Pacific Ocean and Atlantic sea surface temperature patterns as playing a role, that's part of what I'm referring to. You know, we had a La Nina event that lasted until the first couple of months of 2012, making 2012 was actually the hottest La Nina year on record for planet Earth. And that's notable because La Ninas usually tend to cool global surface temperatures just a little bit. So we were supposed to go into an El Nino, and I say supposed to because that was the consensus of most computer models and most experts, but then it kind of just didn't happen. And, you know, week after week would go by when, you know, the Pacific was kind of refusing to cooperate with the atmosphere above the Pacific, and they weren't really getting along, and you need coupling, they call it. You need sea surface temperatures and winds to change in a way that reinforces the changes in sea surface temperatures. And that did not happen. So where we're headed, it looks like most of the first part of 2013 into the spring and maybe into the summer will feature neither El Nino or La Nina conditions. In other words, neutral conditions. And then we'll see what happens next fall and winter. We can't quite predict that far out.
Well, as you know, Andrew, the last massive El Nino, the really big one, was in the winter of 97-98 when global heat records were set. And since then, we've been dumping greenhouse gases in the atmosphere at ever-increasing rates. Sure, we had some cooling pollution as well. But I'm wondering whether if we get a strong El Nino one of these years, maybe in conjunction with a solar eruption or two, we might shock the world with an all-time record heat. Do you think we could see a relatively sudden jump?
I don't really think that there's much question about that. I think most climate scientists would say that if we get an El Nino, particularly even just a mild to moderate one, it's going to be very likely that we'll set a new record and that that would look like a relatively sudden jump. You know, the heating that's been going on since 1998 has been going into certain layers of the oceans. We see all sorts of indications that the world continues to warm. And, you know, there's the whole meme that the world has not warmed since 1998, which is just really misleading and not true. But I think everybody kind of expects that the next El Nino year will be the warmest year. And we kind of expected it to take place in 2013 with an El Nino, but that kind of petered out. So,
are there any big stories you're looking for in 2013 as we go along into this new year?
Well, I think that the climate science stories that I'm following and Climate Central is following, we're really trying to get a handle on what our capabilities are in terms of attributing different extreme events to climate change and how much that field is developing and how quickly. I'm really interested in seeing what the Obama administration is able to do without Congress to get a handle on, you know, the United States' emissions problems. That's from a policy perspective. At Climate Central, we're doing a lot of work on researching sea level rise and visualizing sea level rise and what the impacts of that mean for people, especially in a post-Hurricane Sandy world. So we're looking ahead to that. I think that there's just so much information coming out so frequently on climate change. And I think that there are so many unknown questions about how man-made change interacts with natural variability, and a lot of studies coming out pretty constantly about that. So I think we'll continue to solve some certain mysteries and then embark on new endeavors. I know one area that scientists are looking to get more information on in particular, actually two that I just realized. One concerns the Southern Oceans, which is trying to figure out how that whole carbon sink functions and get a handle on how much we're changing it already. And the other one concerns Antarctica. And we've just learned just in the past few months that there's been more warming over much of the continent than we have previously thought, and that Greenland may not have played as much of a role in sea level rise thousands of years ago as we thought. A lot more of it may have come from Antarctica, which is pretty unsettling because we thought that the West Antarctic ice sheet was more stable than that. So we shall see what comes out.
It should be another wild year. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest has been Andrew Friedman. Andrew is the senior science writer for Climate Central. You can find that at climatecentral.org. And I've added Climate Central to my daily must-read list. I think you should, too. Andrew, it's been good talking with you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith, and I've got questions. You've got questions. Why does our society seem crazier every day? Do millions of people really hope this system will collapse, and how do they cope when it doesn't? And how will any of us live with this bad news about climate change? How do we really feel inside about it? For a way to find some of those answers, it's time to check in with the original peak oil shrink. Dr. Kathy McMahon is a clinical psychologist. She's recognized internationally for her writing about psychological impacts of peak oil, climate change, and the economic collapse. In October 2010, I interviewed Kathy about the pathological optimism of people who think this fossil economy will go on forever, just like a 1950s TV show. Kathy, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, it's great to be here, Alec.
Well, I'm glad to get you back on the program. We've just done a series of really depressing shows. I have to admit, scientists are predicting 4 or 6 degrees of warming this century, more ugly weather. One even talked about the possibility of human extinction. It's tough stuff to deal with. Is there a psychology of doom?
Oh, I think absolutely. And I think it's been with us since the beginning of time. One of the things that we've always sort of taken an interest in is the end times. Of course, what that means to all of us is that we age and we die. So I think it has sort of universal appeal that there are shifts in our own personal lives. But I think also that there are really powerful shifts culturally. And booms and busts have been with us all through time. And during the boom times, we feel strong, we feel optimistic, we feel like we can control the earth and dominate everything within our viewpoint. And when we go through bust times, we feel hopeless and helpless, and we feel completely pessimistic about the future, and we begin to doubt whether there'll even be a future. And so, yeah, I think that has been written about for a very long time, the psychology of booms and busts. health. And I think part of the challenge is really not to succumb to either the ecstatic optimism on the way up or the despairing pessimism on the way down.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, people can't resolve what's going to happen with energy or climate or this fake economy. And as you say, it's been promised by religions over the ages that there would be an end time. And lately it's been the Mayan calendar thing or Mayan calendar and a mystery planet or an alien conspiracy. What do you think about this return to superstition we've seen, especially over the internet?
I think the thing that, as a psychologist, worries me about all of that is that, you know, there was a young woman who was in her late teens or early 20s, and she really took all that stuff to heart and felt like, well, there really wasn't any point in continuing to live, and killed herself. And so, I mean, as a psychologist, I look at that stuff, and there's a lot of comfort, I think, in some ways, in being certain about anything. And I think that that also has a very powerful history in terms of our fortune tellers. We don't like our fortune tellers to hedge their bets, you know. We like people to be definite about what's definitely going to happen and by next Tuesday. And those are the people who tend to get the biggest readership, and they tend to be the ones who are the talking heads on television. But they also tend to be less accurate in their predictions. And I think one interesting psychological phenomenon is that when they're wrong about what they predict, in general, people kind of forget about what the prediction was. Of course, they forget, and what they want to do is, on the rare times that they're correct, they want to point to that and talk about quite a bit about how they were right during this or that prediction that they made. So I think that there's a psychology that's involved in even looking at the future, and a general psychology among people to want to know, want to be able to figure out what they should be doing based on what someone else says is going to be happening in the future. History has demonstrated to us over time that, you know, we have these odd events that happen and kind of throw off, you know, even our best predictions of what's likely to happen. And so I think it's kind of diminishing returns to spend all of our lives listening to predictors of the future and trying to make individual decisions based on global trends, even if those trends seem very, very convincing to us.
Well, and you raised another thing I've been thinking about. As people get older, most of them begin to accept they'll die. Nature sort of prepares our brains, and we might even accept death if we've been in pain. And then we layer that tendency onto this big assumption by baby boomers that they speak for society. You know, we in the media tends more and more to represent those geriatric news anchors and pundits and to be blunt, people of our generation. And I know that drives younger people nuts, by the way. So, Kathy, my question is, could our belief that things are falling apart be just an illusion created by this generation of older minds who are programmed to think that way towards the end of their lives?
I do think that we have an enormous impact on the way that we view culture and the influences that we've had on culture itself. But I don't think that that's the whole story. There are issues, there are certainly principles that are impacting us that are beyond just psychology itself. And of course, I'm not an economist and I'm not an environmental scientist or an oil geologist for that matter, but I do believe that there's something beyond what we think and what we imagine. I really do think that the forces are in play for, you know, limits to growth. I think that our generation is, and that the demographics involved in our generation is just one piece of that puzzle.
Well, for sure. There is a reality. I mean, the ice in the Arctic has melted, so it's definitely happening. Well, along those lines, you've just had a visit with somebody who speaks about this, Nicole Foss. She's known as Stonelay at that popular blog, The Automatic Earth. Would you care to tell us about your visit with Nicole?
Nicole is an incredible mind. I mean, she's a woman in her 40s who has already really developed a reputation for herself. Before she got into finance talking about peak oil, she was one of the people who ran the energy drum in Canada. What strikes me, I had a chance to do an interview with her myself. We started talking. I was trying to get some information that's on the more personal side, you know, being a psychologist. And before I knew it, we had talked for 4 straight hours. fascinating conversations. She is that kind of person. She just came out with a 4-DVD set of her talks on energy and the economy and a few other CDs to boot. And really, her information that she presents is so dense, is so thorough. You know, having her in my house was wonderful because we literally could, I could say, well, you know, what about this element of what you said and what about that element? One of the things that she was very clear about is that she really does see a deflationary period happening in the world and just what that means. It's a pretty frightening perspective that she has.
Well, we don't know what deflation really is. We've been living in inflationary times for so long. I guess the last example we had was the Great Depression.
Radio EcoShock on London's Resonance 104.4 FM.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Kathy McMahon. She's the peak oil shrink. I just listened to your interview with the podcaster KMO from SeaRealm.com. And listeners, that's a podcast to check out. You can find a link in my blog at ecoshock.info or just go to sea-realm.com. In that interview with KMO, Kathy, you triggered a bunch of thoughts I've been stewing about, like, what happens if we get an ugly, slow decline instead of a collapse? You called it a sucky collapse. What do you mean by that?
Well, a sucky kind of collapse is one that's just not dramatic. You know, food prices keep sneaking up, and they shrink the cans and keep the price the same, so you have a hard time noticing it. It's almost invisible unless you're actually impacted by it. I have a friend who is in the office technology business, and he and I were talking, and one of the things that he's seeing, because he's a salesperson, he goes around and talks to a lot of business people, is 2 years ago, he'd visit these same companies, and he'd speak to the person who was running the company, and he'd go back 2 years later to find that the same individual is now working for two separate companies half-time. And he said that he was recently approached, his company, office technology company, was recently approached by two large companies, corporations, and both of them wanted his company to sell their products because they don't have a sales force anymore, that's one of their ways of cutting back. And in my own experience, I was working for a mental health clinic and had been offered a job, a full-time job, managing their training for psychology students. And what ended up happening is the same similar story, which is they hired one person to be the director, and they ended up giving her two jobs. That one of the jobs, which I was planning to get, and this job running the clinic, and handed me a few extra hours and said, run the program. So just heard from my daughter yesterday, in fact, who was told by the company, the nonprofit that she works for, that they're creating a new position. And it's not only her job, but it's another set of responsibilities in addition to that. And so this is what we're seeing in a sucky kind of collapse. We're seeing that we don't get any raise in pay, or maybe our benefits get cut, and so we actually are losing money. And suddenly, instead of doing one job, we now do two jobs. And if we're going to complain about it, then we risk losing those two jobs that we're only getting paid one salary for. It's like that. It's a process whereby everything is just more difficult, you know? Gas is just, you know, increasingly sneaking up there, more and more expensive. That vacation that we were planning on taking, there's just not the money to do it because the everyday expenses in life have really started to create debt for us. And to take on more debt when we're uncertain about our job, you know, is anxiety provoking for us. The anxiety increases. I see that a lot in my practice. The sense of despair and depression in not really being able to feel optimistic about the future and about your career, your education. Cutbacks are starting to happen, and you're aware of it. Like one of the universities just announced a whole series of cutbacks. And so all of these things, I think, play on our minds. They're not the zombie apocalypse where, you know, we're seeing tanks coming down the middle of our city streets, or we're seeing motorcycle gangs with leather jackets and machine guns. We're just seeing everyone around us gradually getting poorer. having less resources, being able to paint their house less often, not being able to update their automobile. And, you know, Dmitry Orlov says, you know, just looking shabbier. It's an emotional drain for the individual. It's an emotional drain on the family to really start to seriously question, are they going to have the cash to be able to send their child to college, or are they going to have the ability to send their child to summer camp when, you know, 5 years ago there wasn't really a question that that would be something that they would be able to do. So that's what I mean by it. And in some ways, I think, because it's a slow, stepwise deterioration, or what Nicole talks about is a lightning bolt deterioration, where it seems to get a little better. Like right now in the United States, the real estate market is improving. The prices for getting a mortgage are rock bottom. And so it looks like we're on the upswing. Everything looks kind of positive, but then it drops down. And each time it goes up, it never quite goes up quite as high as it was before. And when it drops down a little bit more. And our optimism begins to wane even on the upswing. You know, we're not quite as optimistic as we were the last time that they said we're out of the recession and things are turning around, because we don't see that actually happening in our everyday lives. Our everyday lives are still filled with the stresses that's involved with higher energy costs, fewer employment opportunities. And, you know, I was thinking about the logical progression of this energy technology company and, you know, understandably the survival strategy of these companies that are attempting to cut their costs by using somebody else's salespeople. But what that ultimately means is that there will be fewer people employed. And as a result of having fewer people employed, there are fewer people to buy the product, which means that there's a general slowdown in production. Which means, you know, so you can only go so far in draining the resources of a culture. You know, if people aren't working, they can't buy the product. If they don't buy the product, they cut back on the workforce. And that's, I think, what Nicole is talking about when she's talking about pushing on a string with deflation, is that you just can't get a foothold into stopping that gradual, sucky kind of deterioration of people's everyday lives.
I was just listening to Max Kaiser broadcasting out of the UK, and he was talking about what's happening in the United Kingdom, and there they've hit their triple-dip recession, as they call it. Well, really, that's a depression. And yet, people are still going out for dinners, expensive dinners, in downtown London. We don't know what's happening out in the countryside so much. A lot of people are in deep, deep debt. They're in deep, deep poverty, and they can no longer define themselves according to their jobs. And that's something that you just raised, is maybe a lot of us have to rethink who we are. We can't define ourselves in terms of our jobs.
Well, I think it's always been a kind of a risky proposition to define yourself in terms of what you do for a living. And I think, though, that it's part of the delusion that gets created when money becomes such a strong priority in a culture. You know, I'm thinking about just the extent to which employment has taken priority over family life for so many of us. And even people who are very invested in their family life themselves have found themselves in a situation where they don't even eat dinner anymore as a family. You know, if you don't eat dinner as a family, or maybe you can manage it once a week or something, but if other things take priority, whether it's the kids' sporting events or working late, or and it's moving from dinner to even breakfast, we're now having expectations from corporations that we have breakfast meetings. So we can't even, you know, share a bowl of cereal with our kids anymore. When that starts to happen, to answer the question, who am I, we then have to look at our employment circumstance, because that takes up such an enormous amount of our lives. And at least from what I can see, it's going to take even more of a chunk out of us when now, instead of just doing one person's job to in order to cut back and to stay afloat, corporations are expecting us to do two people's jobs. And when we say there's not enough time in a day, their answer is, well, we'll find somebody who can create more time to devote to it. So I think that it's seductive to do that in the go-go times when you're ending up getting promotions, you're ending up getting more money, more praise from the people around you. But I think it's also, just in terms of physical limitation, it becomes overwhelming and a dominant part of your life when you end up working overtime without being paid for it and really worrying about your ability to perform in order to just keep your job.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Kathy McMahon. She's the peak oil shrink, and we're talking about the possibility of a gradual decline, which she calls a sucky collapse. When I hear you talking, I'm reminded of the struggles that many of us have trying to convince other people, including people we love sometimes, that things are not going well, that we may have to readjust our expectations. There's denial about climate change. And I'm wondering whether all of that denial comes out of a deep, deep fear that we're just going to fall off some edge and be downright poor.
It depends upon how you define poverty, because I think that for a lot of us, especially in the United States, we've already been poor. We've already been suffering from a poverty of spirit, a poverty of beliefs in something other than material possessions, and a real paucity of involvement in community-type activities. I think we've been kind of sold a bill of goods, which says that we can live a virtual life and we can have a virtual community, and that that's the same as having a real life with real intimate people that we're involved with on a day-to-day basis and a loving partner and emotionally connected children and a community that we really care about. I think that we lost a tremendous amount of community connection, or what I call, you know, being a patch of ground people, a quote from Neil Young, one of Neil Young's songs. But, you know, a patch of ground people means that, you know, you've really invested in a particular area. You know, you really care what happens to the soil, what happens to the trees, what happens to the quality of the living space, not just for yourself and your own particular plot, but a recognition that your whole town is going to need to thrive in order for you to feel good and for your kids to be safe, for it to be a high quality of life. So if you've invested so much of your emotional energy in economics and you really have allowed your attachment to the land around you to wane because you're moving and you're relocating every once in a while to a different area, if you've allowed your attachment, your passionate connection to your most intimate others to take a back seat to the demands for material goods, the demands for promoting yourself and your employment situation, and even a spiritual connection with any kind of religious or spiritual tradition or community involvement. If you've let all that lapse in favor of money, then yeah, you got a lot to be afraid of when you're looking at a downed economy and when you lose your job, when you lose your title, whatever that title is. Because you then have to go home, you know, like a puppy that was caught in a rainstorm. You gotta come home into a house that does not have a lot of warmth to it anymore, that you haven't invested that everyday, day in and day out quality of life connection, which really turns a house into a home. So yeah, I think that there's a lot of reasons why people, you know, do become frightened and fearful of losing their job. And it's not just because of the shift in lifestyle that they're required to do, but, you know, without the 142 channels of television, you got to sit and look at somebody who you've been living with for 10 or 20 or 30 years and talk and share dreams when those dreams are still going to be alive to create some kind of a dream when money as a social lubricant has evaporated for you. But I think that the real concern is the poverty of spirit and the belief system that so many of us find ourselves in. You know, the opposite being, you know, we're not poor, we just don't have any money, which a friend of mine many, many years ago said. And that's a person who, you know, they have no money. So for entertainment, they're going down to the food pantry and they're giving out food, or they're cooking and serving people who have even less than they do. But for other people, not having money means that they're genuinely poor because there's nothing else going on in their life other than their ability to entertain themselves through cash.
Well, you know, there's a constant movement between the city and the country. I plan to leave the big city in 2014. I'm going to keep doing the radio show from a rural village where I can grow some vegetables and be more in touch with nature. That's partly insurance against what I see as the developing decline, whether it's slow or fast. But you know some people who are leaving that rural area and coming back to the city. Do you want to tell us about that?
Well, I was surprised in my interview with KMO that he's left the farm and decided in Tennessee and decided to move to New York City. So he lives in Brooklyn, I believe, at this point, and really has quite a cosmopolitan lifestyle that he's just grooving on, that he's digging. And I think for myself, one of the things that I came to the conclusion of after really thinking a lot, I mean, a lot of things came together with Nicole Foss's visit. But one of the things that really became clear to me is that we're living in an enormous house. We've got 9 acres. We're surrounded by all 3 sides, actually 4 sides, by woods. You can't see our house from the road. And, you know, we have the ability to farm. We have chickens. We had geese at one time. We have the ability to cut our own firewood and heat in our stove. We have an enormous amount of food stored and all that kind of stuff. But what we realized was that despite all of that, as we're aging, one of the real advantages is to be able to be in a small city or a large town and be able to be, you know, walking distance from other people and activities and things like that. And so we are kind of bucking the trend in a lot of ways. We're going from a really rural environment into a much more, not certainly as large as New York City by any stretch of the imagination, but we're looking to be in a kind of walkable small city. And that's been an enormous shift for us in our thinking. And it really has shaken us up in terms of the way that we have traditionally thought and planned about what the future holds. We've prepared for a future that now we're just going to have to completely revamp what our goals are. And certainly I think there'll be many of our friends who won't at all be able to understand why we would make a choice like this. But for us, you know, in order to, we're entering into our 60s, and for us, the firewood could be all there ready, but if you're not capable and skilled in being able to cut it down and bring it in, that's a problem. And if you're 40 or 50 minutes away from any kind of a food store and you have a bad harvest one year, that puts you into a very difficult position when the price of gas continues to go up and up and up. So, and never mind just the morality issue of having 2 people living in a huge house and all of the fossil fuels that it takes to keep a house like this going. So we're hoping to really be able to dramatically downscale and live in a much, much smaller place, be able to be in a walkable location where our output of fossil fuels will be dramatically less. And really, I think both of us are kind of, with some fear and intrepidation, we're looking forward to investing into a community again and doing more work in being able to be part of a small city, part of the life of a large town. So that's our plan, and that's just hot off the presses right now.
That's big news, big news. Well, we've talked a bit about seniors. I think we should talk about young people, and a lot of them have record massive student debt, and you can't discharge it with bankruptcy. It's a lifetime thing. Many young people won't get jobs they've been trained for, and I'm thinking about some countries, including European countries like Spain and Italy, where a lifetime of working is possible, where people just never do get a job. It could happen in England, America, or Canada. How will people adjust to that internally in their minds?
I think that you can look at it in a number of different ways. One of the ways that you can look at it is that we don't have debtor prison. And so it means that there's going to be a lot of people, young people, who will be in enormous amounts of debt that they just can't service, period. They just can't do it. They can't find work, and even if they do find work, they can't find work that's going to generate enough income for a lot of them to be able to pay off the student loans that are the equivalent of a mortgage payment for a lot of these kids. So I think that what you're going to see is you're going to see a lot of underground economy operating, and that doesn't get taxed to pay student loans. And I think that the biggest shift is going to be a psychological one, that they're going to have to accept the fact that they're living in a time where they are just going to have this state, which is a student loan, and whether it's floating over their heads and it makes for sleepless nights, or it's just a piece of paper that comes periodically that says you owe more money this month than you did last month, and that they're going to try and put it in its place, which is, that's one of the things I can't do anything about, you know? But I've written about this, and I'll tell you that of all of the stories that I've ever written about and gotten replies, email replies about, I have to tell you that the story that I wrote on the student loan debacle was really the most upsetting of all of them, because I think that one of the ways that you create despair in a culture is that you take your young people and, as I said in the piece, you put them in a barn, you lock the door, and then you burn the barn down. And I think that that's what, in the United States anyway, that's what we've done. And just recently, Obama's made some changes to try and lessen the onerous nature of student loans and made some changes in that front. But it did nothing for the people who graduated before he signed that legislation into law. So for so many folks, I think that they really will have to, and I've seen it with my own daughter, they really will have to invest in something other than being able to have, you know, typical commercial credit, credit cards, mortgage, car loans, and that kind of thing. They're really going to need to live in a very dramatically different way by force of circumstance. And how they will approach that is going to, I think, depend to a large extent on the extent to which they've accepted that they've been caught in a historical period that they had no control over. Just like if you were 20 at the point where the Great Depression hit, you can either look at it in terms of the worst thing that ever happened to you, or there's one story I particularly like where the guy said when the Depression hit, he'd set up a business, and the business crashed, and he lost everything. So he said that suddenly he felt free because he hated business, and he started to write songs because he loved to rhyme. And before you knew it, people liked to hear his rhyming and his songs and started buying sheet music. And he became quite popular as a songwriter, whereas had the Depression not hit, he would have continued in his business and have been led a quite miserable life from the way that he describes it. So I think to a large extent it's going to be the attitude that the young people have about whether they've accepted the fact that they're in a historical period, that, you know, they are living in dramatic times and that it's not their fault to find themselves in these dramatic circumstances and to be able to accept it as a piece of paper instead of the burden, the anxiety, the depression that can come with feeling like they're deeply in debt and they'll never get out of it.
Well, as you say, there's no debtor's prison, and in a way, they're better off than the pot-smoking generation of the late 60s. The United States is still arresting about 800,000 people a year for simple possession of marijuana. And so that was kind of a historical accident, in my opinion, because the legislators like to drink, and many of them drank plenty. You know, we all want to know how this is going to turn out, and I could see for North America especially a kind of fork in the road here, and it could go both ways, where to some degree, we see crazy violence. You know, we saw that school shooting, just nutty stuff. And at the same time, we hear about more communities developing and young people going into communities and trying out new things. Are we going to be able to tolerate those two streams at the same time, where things fall apart and things come together?
Yeah, I think that we're going to have to. And of course, we always have. There has always been some level of mental illness, and that's what we saw with that Sandy Hook shooting. There have always been situations, and of course, if it's not guns, it'll be like it is in China, it's machetes and cars that run children down. So I think that that's a given. But so much of what makes us human involves things that have very little to do with how much money we have in our pockets or violence around us. It has to do with our feelings of support by the people in our lives. And I think that even when you live in a violent neighborhood, humans are noted for their ability to adjust and to take certain things for granted and to be able to live their lives anyway, despite the rise in crime or that kind of thing. So I think, yeah, I think that isn't a very popular book starting out saying it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. Clearly, one of the things that happened during the Great Depression is that people got together, and when they did, they would have rent parties, and the band would play, and when people walked in, they threw what they could throw in a hat to help the people who were throwing the party to be able to pay the back rent so that they wouldn't be booted out on the street. And they partied all night, and they had fun. And so I think that we're gonna see that. And just like I think the key important thing for me is, just like when you have a monkey who sticks his paw into a jar and he wants that banana and he wants to pull that banana out, but he can't do it while he's holding on to the banana. If he lets the banana go, his hand can slide out no problem, and he wants his hand out, but he wants the banana too. And so I think that that's our biggest challenge, is that if we're going to be insisting like that monkey on holding on to that banana, holding on to wealthier times, insisting on, you know, living in bigger homes and insisting on the lifestyle that we can no longer afford, we're going to remain miserable. But if we can understand that there are just some things that have changed for us in our lives, and to let go and to pull our hand out and to go on and do the next thing, I think that that will provide us an opportunity to be able to have a quality of life. Because as I'm fond of saying, look, we only have one lifespan. We are mammals. We're entitled to have a good, high-quality life for the time that we're here. And lamenting that it isn't the same life that we might have had 10 years or 20 years ago is just a tremendous waste of time, because we are here now, and we do have moment by moment by moment the ability to really appreciate whatever benefits that we're currently being offered. So, you know, again, so much of it is, in fact, psychological, despite the fact that we may not be living at the same level, that we may be facing enormous challenges, as we certainly are, not only in the economy, but also in the environment, in the energy sector, et cetera. But I think that our ability to remain optimistic about our own potential, optimistic about our own capacity to love passionately, to care passionately, to be invested passionately in a particular place, because this is the place, this is the time that we find ourselves in, is going to be very, very, very important.
Dr. Kathy McMahon, do you have upcoming speaking events or publications or a blog that you would like to tell us about?
I'm still working on my book, I Can't Believe You Think That, which is a book that talks about intimate arguments about some of the most important issues of our time, like peak oil, climate change, and economic shifts. So that's still something that's ongoing. And, of course, I'm going to be editing this four-hour talk that I had with Nicole Foss, and I'll be putting that on my website as well for people to be able to enjoy. In addition to making my chickens fatter so that we can slaughter them over the next few months and have them for dinner.
Well, I've done that myself. I've killed a few chickens and eaten them. So that's all at peakoilblues.com. Is that where we find it?
It's Peak Oil Blues, and actually the blog is peakoilblues.org/blog.
Okay, peakoilblues.org/blog for Kathy McMahon. She's a clinical psychologist who advises, writes, speaks about the energy threshold known as peak oil and climate change and severe economic stress. I've got a link to a great YouTube interview on Peak TV in my own blog at ecoshock.info. Kathy, I always feel better after talking with you, but I guess that's the point of talking with a psychologist. Thanks so much for helping us on Radio EcoShock.
It was my pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith. Next week on Radio EcoShock, we'll have more science, of course. I'll be talking with one of the big brains on biodiversity, Dr. Thomas Lovejoy. It seems even when we know the facts, humans don't act. We'll explore those mental blocks and the people who get past all that with the popular speaker, author, and advisor, Dr. Carolyn Baker. Find links for this show in my blog at ecoshock.info and help me keep going if you can. Find out more at the website, too, ecoshock.org. There's lots to download there for free. As Kathy McMahon said, we have but one life to live. I'm Alex Smith, saying be kind to yourself, take it a day at a time, and find others to help you through the big change. We'll go out the way we came in with Seattle's Jim Page singing, Whose World Is This?
What kind of world would our children receive after all is said and done? What kind of creed have we come to believe that they may never receive?